Welcome to Going In Blind. I'm your host, Zach Tidwell, and my guest today is an Army veteran and police captain who was involved in a deadly shooting in 2016. It changed his entire life, but today he's a certified peer support specialist and founder of Stop the Threat, Stop the Stigma. But before we hop into the show, I do have a couple quick announcements. First, my book is on the way. Some of you may not know this, but like many of my guests, I have a pretty wild story myself. And I've seen through sharing it over the past several years that it can save lives. So I wrote a memoir. I'm currently working through 3 rounds of editing with my editor, and then it'll be out in the world. And if you want a quick overview of my story, you can go back and listen to the trailer for this show or go to my website at zachtidwell.com to read about it. And while you're there, join my mailing list so you can get updates about the book and any other big announcements that I have moving forward. Finally, the best way to help this show grow outside of word of mouth is to follow, rate, and review it in whatever podcasting app you're using right now. Or if you're on YouTube, just subscribe to the show. And if you know someone you think I should talk to, have them send me an email at contact.goinginblind@gmail.com. Now here's the show. Please welcome Adam Myers. All right, Adam, thanks for coming on. We were just talking offline. I think we've both been equally excited for this. So
I agree.
I think this is probably going to get really heavy really quickly, but I think that's where... You know, that's really where the value kind of gets derived from these conversations is in getting into the difficult stuff. And so
right. I hope so. Heavy is good. I mean, that's how you get it out and talk about it. And thanks, Zach, for giving me this opportunity. It really means a lot to me.
Yeah, man. And in trying to figure out how I wanted to go about this, I want to get back into your whole, there's a lot of touching points in your resume and your notes that you sent over to me, but I think the best way to do this is probably start with the incident in 2016 and then maybe work backwards and then back to today. So you tell everyone a little bit about what happened in 2016 and we'll roll from there.
Absolutely. On Friday, April 8th, 2016, at about 5:15 p.m., I was dispatched to our Walmart. I was at the police department working on a retail theft report from another retail store when I was dispatched to Walmart, and it wasn't a very emergent call at all. It was assist two chaperones with somebody refusing to leave the store, and we do that all the time. We respond to restaurants and retail stores and people's homes and you name it. I mean, it wasn't that big of a deal. So I grabbed my laptop and walked out the back of the police department, jumped in my squad car and started driving to Walmart. It was about probably less than 2 miles away. And what I didn't know was the call initially came into dispatch as a 911 hangup call. And dispatch called them back and found out that the two chaperones were at Walmart with a woman. Her name was Melissa. And she struggled with mental health, and she was refusing to leave the store. And they were concerned because she had a history of violence, and she was trying to remove a knife from the packaging back in the sporting goods section. So they relayed that to me, and once I found that out, then I just started stepping it up. I turned my lights and sirens on. I started traveling at a higher rate of speed because this is a different type of call now.
Yeah.
So all Walmarts, if you're not aware, are pretty much set up the same way. In the back of the store, you have the auto center, you have the sporting goods center, or the sporting goods section, and she was back in the sporting goods section with what we found out later was a hatchet. But I told all the other responding police officers that I was going to respond through the auto center because I was hoping to isolate her at the back of the store so she wouldn't walk up towards the front of the store. Like I said, it was 5:15 p.m. on a Friday, super busy, hundreds of people in the store. But while I was responding, that changed because she started walking towards the front of the store. She started threatening customers. She started damaging merchandise. So what I did was I responded to the general merchandise entrance. And Walmart usually has two entrances. One's a general merchandise and the other one's a grocery entrance. And I remember when I pulled into the parking lot, there were people in the way. My squad car had the lights and sirens going. I'm driving in there. Nobody would get out of the way. Everybody's kind of looking like, hey, look at that cop car. What's going on? And I'm thinking, will you please move? There's a true emergency in the store. So what I did was I parked right in front of the general merchandise entrance. I turned my siren off, and I left my red and blue lights, my emergency lights, going, because I was hoping that if anybody else was going to enter through Walmart, that they would see my police car and figure maybe I shouldn't go through that door. Because I knew she was walking towards the front of the store. I didn't know exactly where she was, but I thought that was a good idea to kind of block the entrance with a police vehicle. And when I exited, I drew my weapon and ran into Walmart, right into the vestibule. I had no idea where she was. She could have been right inside the door. Once I got into Walmart, I saw a man and woman standing in front of me, and I said, where is she? Where is she? And they pointed down towards the lawn and garden, or the health and beauty aisle, that area. And that's like a main intersection in Walmart. So I ran down there, and I first made contact with her. Her back was towards me, and she was hacking up merchandise on a pallet. And I identified myself, and that's when she turned and faced me, and I realized that wasn't a knife. She's got a hatchet. And not that a knife would have been any less threatening or dangerous, but that's what I was thinking it was initially, like a pocket knife. And when she turned and faced me, I saw the hatchet. Then I gave her multiple verbal commands to stop and drop the hatchet. She continued to advance towards me, and that's when I decided to shoot her. I shot twice, and my first round went in and out of one of her legs, and the second round struck her kind of center mass near the sternum, and she fell to the ground. And I know that when I pulled the trigger that I changed lives. Not only did I take Melissa's life, I changed my life. I changed everyone in the store that witnessed the shooting, even people who were anywhere else in the store. They could have been clear across the store in the grocery aisle and heard gunshots. And, you know, forever, now they have a story. When they were at Walmart, the cop shot somebody. I remember my gunshots being so loud, and I remember the first thing that happened to me was everything, clarity came back to me. And the only way that I can explain it is it kind of sounded like this. It kind of sounded like shh. And then everything was crystal clear. And the first thing I remember hearing was one of Melissa's chaperones. She had to have been probably 50 feet away from me. And she said something like, it's the cop, it's the cop, he just shot her. And it felt like she was right next to me, whispering in my ear.
Because your senses are heightened from the adrenaline. And yeah,
I was really tuned in. And I didn't realize that until days later when I listened to the 911 call. And I'm like, oh my gosh, she was way over there. But it felt like she was whispering in my ear. So the first thing I remember seeing were these brightly colored beach towels on this end cap. I remember looking around to the customers that were standing around and said, please check yourself. Please check each other. I wanted to make sure that my bullets didn't hit anybody else. And then I remember looking at, it was a Walmart employee. I don't know if it was just an associate or a manager or whoever they were. And I said, can you please get on the intercom and ask for a nurse or a doctor? And if there's one in the store, will you please come over here and help until the ambulance arrives? And by chance, there happened to be a nurse in the light bulb aisle right around the corner from where the shooting happened. And she raised her hand and said, I'm a nurse, I'm a nurse. And later on, I found out that she was in the light bulb aisle picking out light bulbs. And I was yelling, you know, giving verbal commands so loudly, stop, drop, drop it, that she actually dropped the light bulb she was holding because she thought I was yelling at her, and nobody else was in the aisle. So the ambulance did arrive and you know, take her to the hospital. And unfortunately, she did die several hours later after surgery. It's my understanding they couldn't stop the internal bleeding and she died. I didn't know that right away. I didn't know that until the next day. But my corporal arrived, and my corporal was my field training officer when I first started at that police department. And it was great to have him there because it was somebody that knew me. I knew him. I felt comfortable and safe. Because everything seems surreal. Part of me was like, I know what I just did. But then part of me felt like, this isn't real. I mean, I live in this community. I shop at this Walmart all the time. And now I just shot somebody.
Yeah.
So my corporal brought me to his squad car and we sat there briefly and he's like, hey, look, and he pointed out his window and the media was there almost immediately. And, you know, one of the members of the media came up to the passenger side of the squad car and just started asking questions like, hey, do you know what's going on in there? And they didn't know that I was the officer that shot somebody. And we just gave them, I don't really remember what we said, but, and then shortly after that, we drove back to the police department. And once I was cleared from the police department to go home, I jumped in my squad car and drove home. And I had a take-home squad car. I was still in uniform. They had taken my gun, but I was still in uniform. And once they said I was good to go and could go home, I was like, okay, I don't want to be here. I want to go home where I'm, you know, where I feel safe and where I feel comfortable. And so I got my squad car. And the first thing I did was I reached up to my visor because that's where my cell phone was. And I noticed a whole bunch of missed text messages and mixed phone calls. But the first thing I thought of is I have to call my mom and dad. Because they lived about 3.5-4 hours away. And I wanted them to know what happened and know what happened to me and let them know that I was okay, even though I wasn't. I was in shock.
Yeah.
I realized it after the fact. But, you know, so I wanted them to hear it from me and not social media or the media or a text message. Hey, did you hear what happened to Adam? So I called them and told my mom and dad what happened. I shot somebody at work. I'm okay. And later on, my mom even said, you know, we had talked about this and she goes, honey, you're my baby boy. When you called me, I could tell you weren't okay. I could tell you were in shock. I didn't even recognize your voice. I knew it was my son talking to me. But so I drove home after I had that conversation with my mom and dad. And I don't remember the route I took home. I could probably tell you the route I took because I took it all the time, but it was a blur. And I do remember pulling into my driveway and getting out and walking into my house. And I am divorced. I was divorced at the time and I have two daughters. They're older now. They're 27 and 23, but they were young women at the time. They were probably 8 years old and 12 years old, something like that. And so they weren't there. And I just went home to an empty house. And I remember the first thing I did was I walked in to my house and I knelt down next to my love seat and I prayed to God that Melissa wouldn't die. I didn't want her to die. I didn't think she was going to. Because still at Walmart, she was on the ground after I had shot her and she was still talking to paramedics. And so that's the last visual I had of her. Okay, I shot her. I had no idea and I didn't even think she was gonna die. But I went home and prayed to God, you know, please don't let her die. And then I went into my room and took my uniform off and sat at the edge of my bed. And even with all my gear off, I still felt so heavy. And I was just like kind of in shock and it was surreal. I'm at my house after I shot somebody and I didn't know what to do. So I ordered a pizza, turned on the news to see what was being said about me or being said about the shooting. And even though I was told, don't watch the news, stay off the internet, I still hopped on. I wanted to see what was going on. And then I went to bed, you know, after I ate my pizza and I slept great. I slept like a rock, no bad dreams. And I don't know, maybe that has something to do with adrenaline dump. I'm not sure.
I would think so.
Yeah. I mean, I slept great and I woke up Saturday morning and I had the weekend off. That's protocol after a shooting. And, you know, I was going to have the weekend off. And then on Monday, I would go into the sheriff's department who was investigating the shooting and speak with investigators. But Saturday morning, I woke up and I thought to myself, I want to have some kind of sense of normalcy. What can I do that's kind of normal, if that's even possible after shooting somebody? And I thought, you know, I'm going to go get my hair cut because every week I get my hair cut. That's kind of like me time, my personal time. And then after that, I'm going to go pick up my kids. And I was getting ready and I walked out to my car, you know, parked in the driveway. And I looked at my cell phone and it was my chief calling me. And it was the typical, hey, how you doing? I'm doing good. And, then he wanted to know when I could come in and see him. And I told him, well, I'm going to go get my hair cut first. I'm going to go pick up my kids and then I'll come see you. And he told me, Adam, I didn't want to tell you this over the phone, but she died. And that changed everything for me because I knew right then it wasn't just a shooting. I actually killed somebody. And now what's going to happen? And I'm glad the chief told me over the phone because he did like what I did with my mom and dad. He wanted me to know right away. He didn't want me to hear on the news or social media or, hey, buddy, I heard that she died. I hope you're doing well through a text message. He wanted me to know right away. And I respect him for making that decision. But I remember getting off that phone call and just sitting in my SUV and thinking, what next? What's going to, I killed somebody. What's going to happen? And I did go get my hair cut. I don't remember driving there. I barely remember sitting there getting my hair cut. And then I went in and spoke with the chief, and he told me that he was going to release my police department photograph to the media. And I probably should have been thinking about all kinds of other things, but the only thing I could think of when he told me that was, that's my fat picture, and I don't want that on the internet. So I even remember asking the chief, can you give me an hour so I can kind of like Photoshop this photo? Because I know once it gets on the internet, everybody's going to see this thing. You know, my chicken neck, my...
You're going to get roasted by some 15-year-olds.
And he's like,
Reddit.
Yeah, we're not going to do that. And then, I mean, you can Google me right now and you'll know what I'm talking about because you'll see that picture. So, so the weekend was a bore. I still go to therapy now once a week, and my therapist and I were talking about that last month, and I'm like, you know, I don't even remember that weekend. I do remember being by myself, but I don't know. Maybe I was just on cruise control. I don't remember anything I did that weekend after I spoke with the chief. It's all a blur. And then Monday morning, I had to travel to the sheriff's department because they were the lead investigator in the shooting. And I remember driving there worried because for some reason, I thought there wasn't video of my shooting. And we have body cameras. I didn't have a body camera at the time, but Walmart has cameras everywhere.
Yeah.
But it was just stamped in my mind that there was no video. And I'm like, that doesn't make sense. So I'm driving to the sheriff's department thinking, what if there is video? And what if it's not how I remember it? What if I was completely wrong and shouldn't have done what I did? And then when I got there, I was sitting in a room with a couple of attorneys, you know, that were on my side and supported me. And we were just waiting for the investigators to come. And one of them came and he made a comment, and it wasn't sarcastic. It wasn't meant in a sarcastic way, but somebody asked about video. And I remember them saying, oh, we have video. And I'm thinking, what does that mean? And I right then, I was really nervous. And I thought, they have video and it's not going to be how I remembered my shooting. But once we got up into the conference room and watched the videos that they had and listened to the 911 call, it was exactly how I remembered. There's a lot of things I don't remember. I've been told that's your brain protecting you, which is a good thing. But I remember watching myself on video thinking, yeah, that's me doing what I was trained to do, but I don't remember doing that, but that's me. So exactly what I remembered is what was captured on video. So I was relieved then.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm good.
I think it's funny. You've said in a couple different points in the story, like the details that you do remember hearing it as the bystander here, it's funny to hear the little details that do stick out to you. And that you remembered the way people were handling when you were driving in, you remember the vibrant towels and like,
oh yeah,
all these small details. And even I think like when your chief told you that he was going to release your picture and like you thinking like, oh, that's my fat picture. Like, yeah, you're in a blur of, you've got to be now in a different kind of shock hearing that she died. And like, just, you're in this weird mental place where like, you're not, like you said, that like, I probably should have been thinking about other things, but that's the first thing that came into my mind. And you're just, I mean, it had to just be, it's cliche to say, but like just a hurricane of emotions with that. And like how it's just, every time that you mentioned a small detail that you remembered, I just thought it was funny. I'm like, that's what sticks with you. And it's kind of, it's crazy.
Right. And even my gunshots, they were so loud. They echoed so loudly in Walmart. And it just reminded me of like a broken speaker, the two shots. It was just, it's just not normal. You know, I didn't plan to go to work and shoot somebody. I didn't plan to go to work and shoot somebody inside the Walmart I shop at all the time. And now, okay, I just did this and I'm standing there near the lawn and garden and health and beauty aisle after shooting somebody thinking, oh my God, this is real. I did just do this. And this is where I shop. I get my deodorant and my Axe body spray right down that aisle. But no, I shot somebody right here. I mean, it was just, it was surreal. It's like, I can't believe this is happening.
Yeah. And I, if you're cool with it, you know, we talked about this beforehand. Like you said that there's nothing you haven't answered so far, right? In sharing this story over the years. And I would like to, you know, part of this is me, the Marine infantryman in me, wanting to pick this apart. Part of this is my awareness of speaking with a lot of cops over the years, and especially now on the mental health side of things since my suicide attempt, and also just knowing the reality of how there's a lot of things that people aren't necessarily aware of when it comes into the interactions that police have, that especially with people who do have mental health issues and are almost recurring, I don't want to say clients, but you know, people that you run into often, these are people who are having trouble in their lives, and a lot of the way that it gets expressed is ways that end up with encounters with the police. And so I'd like to kind of like go, again, for my own curiosity, but I also think this is valuable for people to stop and think about. Like, yes, they just heard this story. And even like me, I was amped up listening to you tell the story, especially like by the time that you talked about entering into the store, not knowing where the hell she's at. Maybe she's right inside the door. But I think for people to step back through this with us and actually process the implications of some of these things and the actual dynamics outside of the face value of what's going on. And so if you're cool with that, I'd like to start kind of picking your brain on that before we start working back to where we are kind of putting the pin in things right now.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So, you know, when you're rolling up, obviously this isn't urgent at this point. You even mentioned your whole pace, everything was picked up and accelerated once you know, like, all right, this woman now has a weapon. You thought it was a knife, but when you got there and you're rolling in, I mean, did you go into the store with your rifle? Did you just have your sidearm? I know you mentioned you went in with it drawn.
Yeah, I just had my duty weapon. It was a Glock Model 22. It's a 40 caliber. I just had my sidearm. I just exited my patrol vehicle and drew my weapon right away because I didn't know where she was. I knew that she had been threatening customers and that she was walking towards the front of the store, and that's where I was entering the front of the store. So, I mean, she very well could have met me right when the doors opened. So that's what I did. Yep.
Yeah. And that's like, people also may not realize, yeah, you get the call. It's not like you have constant contact with the people in the store. Like, hey, this is where she's at. And now you're going into this and you realize maybe she knows that the cops are coming. Like someone may have said, hey, we're calling the cops. And you mentioned she had issues with mental health in the past, you know. Had you encountered her before or had other officers, like, was she someone that you and your coworkers were familiar with?
Not my coworkers and me. I mean, she did have a history of violence with other law enforcement agencies and other law enforcement officers. She, at the time, she was a patient in a state-run mental health facility. And okay. It's my understanding that she received a good behavior pass or something similar to that. And the two chaperones took her to a restaurant across the street from Walmart, and everything was good to go. Everything was going well. And then they went over to Walmart. And then when they said it was time to leave, she refused to leave, walked away from them, and went right over to Sporting Goods and ripped open the hatchet from the packaging. So, I mean, her past involved, it's my understanding she kicked a deputy in the head, and that changed kind of their transporting policies at their jail. She had written letters to senators, to district attorneys, to other members of the government talking about that she was going to kill them and dismember them. So she had a long history of violence.
And just obviously something was very wrong with mentally with her. So, and that was going to be one of my questions, because I wasn't sure initially when you were mentioning chaperones. I think with the initial call, for some reason, I think I took that as like, okay, people in the store started, like, now they were following her around trying to, you know, do some damage control. But, you know,
And if you listen to the 911 call, you know, one of the reasons why the dispatch center keeps you on the line when you call 911 is so they can hear exactly what's going on, the play by play, and then relay it to the police. So, and that's what they were doing. So you can hear that the two chaperones were following her and even saying, you know, keep some distance. We want to make sure that other people stay away from her. And because she was threatening with the hatchet. And I was told that the two chaperones that were with her weren't the chaperones that are usually with her when she went out on passes. There was another gentleman that worked for the state facility that usually went out on good behavior passes with her, but something happened at the facility that he had to remain on site. So they assigned these two chaperones with her. Now, I don't know if that contributed to her behavior or not. I have no idea. But that's what I was told. It wasn't the normal chaperone that was with her while she was out of the facility.
Gosh. And that's unfortunate for everybody. Like whether that did contribute or not, like it's a tumultuous kind of environment. Obviously, if she's that unstable, and it's like, fuck, man, it's hard, because like obviously she needs that treatment, and if a way to reward her is like to, hey, let's, you've been doing great, let's go do something that you'll enjoy, and then it goes horrible for everyone. Was this your first time responding to a call where it was weapons drawn and you know you're going into a hot environment?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm a former military policeman in the Army, active duty for 5 years. After that, I was hired by the City of Racine Police Department, which is a larger police department. The population at the time was about 85,000, and it's located between Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Chicago, Illinois. So I had my fair share of excitement, I guess you would say. I was also a third shift evidence technician. So I went to major crimes, drive-bys, gang complaints, stuff like that. So it wasn't my very first time. This was my very first deadly force situation where I actually used deadly force on somebody. And over the years, I always prided myself in never using force. I mean, I've used my taser probably a half a dozen times, but in the 23, 24 years I've been a cop, I've never even pepper sprayed anybody. I've never even used my baton on anybody. I've always had, I always prided myself with being able to talk people down and not having to use force. And that's why this, I think one of the reasons why this got to me so much is it didn't work. I'm standing in front of her, a fully uniformed police officer with a gun out, and she's walking towards me. And I'm giving her multiple verbal commands to stop, to drop the hatchet, and she's not listening to me. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. And then I made the decision. I'm shooting. And I know I made the right decision. I have no doubt in my mind. I've never second-guessed myself. Under the same circumstances, I would do it again. And it is unfortunate. It was a tragic day. I never want to take anybody's life, but I've been told many times, Adam, that was real police work. People needed your help, and you showed up, and you made the decision, and you protected people. And that's, you weren't writing a speeding ticket or a parking ticket. That was the real deal. And I agree, but it still doesn't make it easier. It's something that I think about every single day of my life. It never goes away. I'm healthier now because I learned how to positively cope after years of not coping positively. But yeah, it's just something that, you know, when you get into policing, you always know the possibility is there. You could possibly shoot somebody. You may possibly have to go hands-on or use force. But like deadly force, the probability, yeah, it's probably not going to happen. Well, it did happen, and it became my reality. I mean, it happened to me. I was a firearms instructor at the time. So, yeah, I mean, this was my reality. It probably will happen to, hey, it happened and this is happening right now.
Yeah. And it's just like, fuck, man. Like, you hate that for everybody, right? Like, and again, especially because, you know, she wasn't of the right mind. I feel like that makes it, you know, at least from hearing it. I'm curious if does that, I don't know how that wouldn't stick with you either way, right? You took a human life. And I do, just like you're saying, all of your colleagues said, like, that it was real police work and you did the other people there needed you.
Right.
Obviously, yep. Like, you're not in prison, so other people will agree that that was the right call. But, like, is there a specific part of it, knowing that she was not in her right mind, that bothers you along with that, like, eats at you with that? Or is it just the, as a whole, like, this is, you know, it's a fucking difficult thing to have to do.
Yeah. I don't think, I haven't really thought much about that. I just know that I did the right thing. And if somebody had mental health challenges or they were of sound mind and came after me with a hatchet, under the same circumstances, I would have shot them. Because there was hundreds of people in the store. What was I going to do? Keep backing up all the way to the cash registers, keep trying to convince her while her and I walk through the entire rest of the store. You know, if you watch some of the news videos, you'll see parents grabbing their children and kind of pulling them away and running down an aisle because this woman has a hatchet. So I don't think so. I mean, it makes it adds to the situation, and it is sad. It's unfortunate. There's a lot of people who struggle with mental health, but I know I did the right thing. And
yes,
you know, I'm a firm believer. I mean, I believe in God. I was born and raised Lutheran. I believe in God, and I'm a firm believer that when I die, I go to heaven. And I'm hoping that Melissa meets me at the pearly gates with open arms, and she doesn't have any mental health issues, and she's like, "Thank you," that would really be comforting. I'm hoping that'll happen. It's another thing we found out through the investigation was at the time she had a 6-year-old daughter. And my daughters were young. My youngest daughter was trying on 8th grade graduation dresses at the mall when everybody's cell phone got this alert that there was a shooting at Walmart. And she knew that, hey, daddy's working. And then she tried getting a hold of me and couldn't get a hold of me for hours. So she had no idea if I shot somebody, if I was shot, what was going on. She was watching the news. She didn't see me on the news. She saw all the other officers that she recognized, but where's my dad? So, I mean, there's so many other people that are affected by a shooting, not just the officer and the person getting shot.
Yeah. And it's, you know, like I would say what was maybe even more striking to me when you were telling the story the first time was, yeah, I, you know, they took my gun and sent me home.
Yeah.
Like, I'm curious if you feel like there's any, you know, to me, I, again, just not having ever been a police officer or anything like that, that seems like there's a better way to support an officer after a shooting. And I'm curious if you've thought about that, and if so, like, have you thought of a better way that could be handled other than, all right, bye, go home to your family now,
right?
Or maybe go be alone and sit with this.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I speak publicly about what happened to me, my critical incident, and then my mental health, the aftermath. And when I share that part, people are like, you got to be kidding me. You drove home in your squad car in uniform without a gun? And I'm like, yeah. I don't know. At the time, it seemed like the right thing to do. I'm not looking back. No, that's not a good thing. I should have had somebody drive me home, walk in with me. You okay? If you need anything, here's some phone numbers, you know, reach out to family, reach out to us. We're here to support you, not just, okay, we're done here, you can go home. And so, yeah, that shouldn't have happened that way. not only because of the state of mind I was in, but because I was in a marked police vehicle in uniform without a gun.
That's a problem.
I don't remember the drive home. So what if I had another interaction with somebody on the drive home? They see a police car. They don't know I just shot somebody. They don't know what's going on through my head. You know, looking back, at the time, it seemed like the right thing to do. I didn't have any problem with it. They told me to go home, and I was, okay, bye, I'm going home. But thinking over what happened to me, yeah, a lot of things should have happened differently.
Yeah, and that just, like you said, like having someone go with you seems like that would be the right move. And you're like, hey, we're going to have someone just come hang out with you for tonight and tomorrow until Monday when you're coming in, just so you have some company or something. Like it's
right. Because that weekend was a blur. I mean, the drive home was a blur.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize the weekend was a blur, like I said, up until recently when my therapist was asking me, so what happened that weekend? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. It's kind of like I just was on cruise control until Monday when I had to go to the sheriff's department.
I would imagine that's pretty, pretty typical, right? Like,
yeah.
How would you not be after something
right.
like that?
And right.
But that's, you know, as with all of that, and I'm curious too, because I know in the notes that you sent over, you have a background in working in behavioral health as well.
I do. Yep.
So did that all come about after this? And I want to get into the specifically how, like, you know, the effect this had on you. I know that's kind of where we hit pause, but I don't know if you working in behavioral health ties into that timeline as you were starting to struggle and subsequently getting better, or if this was beforehand.
I'm sure it helped. Before I was a police officer, I worked at a few different hospitals that had behavioral health units at the hospital for children and adults. So I had that firsthand experience with people who were struggling with mental health. So I think that helped. I also think it helped that I was a firearms instructor. I mean, knowing why I did what I did and knowing in my head I was justified in doing it, I think that helped me know that I was going to go back to work. I had no doubt in my mind that I was going to be cleared and go back to work. I wanted to go back to work, but I was never worried, man, what if I lose my job? What if somebody files charges against me? I never thought that. I was never worried that I wasn't going to keep my job. I mean, I knew a lawsuit would be coming from the family. I mean, that's typical. But I wanted to go back to work. So I think a combination of having experience, you know, in jobs that I worked in mental health with children and adults helped. And I also think that it helped that I was a firearms instructor.
Yeah. So what was it? I mean, obviously this is where we kind of paused at was, now everything's hit me. And, you know, you went in for the investigation and all that stuff. And that's kind of where we had stopped to go back in the timeline a little bit. How did it actually affect you moving forward? Like what you've hinted at struggles a couple times here. Like what, take me through that.
Right. I struggled in silence for many years, and many years meaning my shooting happened in 2016, and I didn't really start getting the right kind of help until 2022, at the end of, yeah. So, you know, for us, and it's typical, after a shooting, you have some time off on administrative leave and, you know, you get paid and you have time off and they check on you every now and then. And then you have to be cleared by the department psychologist to be able to come back to work. And I did all that. But I remember before I drove home that night, I remember sitting in that conference room and I remember thinking to myself, once I get through all this, I'm talking about it. I'm letting people know what happened and what goes on. I had no idea it was going to take 6 years. I had no idea I was going to go through hell. And what I mean by go through hell, I mean, I abused alcohol. And what I mean by abusing alcohol, I just didn't have a 6-pack or 12-pack of beer. I'd have a glass of wine and I'd make my own cocktails. I'd add like ZQL sleeping medicine. I'd NyQuil. I'd even reach into the medicine cabinet and take my daughter. There was one time my daughter had some cough medicine, prescribed cough medicine, that had codeine in it. So I added that to my wine glass, and I would drink. I was always drinking. And, you know, there was one time I even drank, well, many times, vodka, a 750 milliliter bottle of vodka in less than 30 minutes. And then I would sleep the day away. I would, before I had to go anywhere, it could be grocery shopping, it could be on a date, it could be to meet my kids, it could be anything to kind of take the edge off, I would stop by the nearest gas station and I would buy, you know, these little
like cinnamon the shooters. Whiskey
shooters, two or three of those, and I would drink them right in my car before I even pull out of the parking lot. And I would throw them either in the backseat of my car or throw them out the window while I was driving to where I was heading. And I rationalized myself, this behavior, which is completely wrong. I rationalize that, hey, you know, if I have these, it'll take about 30 minutes to kick in, and then I'll end up being where I'm going, and everything will be fine. But that's not the case. I mean, that's self-destructive behavior. I'm very lucky I wasn't arrested for drunk driving. I'm very lucky I didn't crash my vehicle. I'm very lucky I didn't kill somebody. There was one time I had to pick up my daughter from gymnastics and at her mom's house, my ex-wife, her mom's house, and that was about 20 minutes from where I was living, and I had been day drinking into the early afternoon, and I still knew I had to go pick her up. And was I okay? No. But did I tell myself, I'm good. I'm good. So I hopped in my car and I went and picked her up. And while we were driving to gymnastics, I remember getting off the freeway, and I would either have to take a right and I would go towards the city where gymnastics was, or take a left. Well, I took a left and drove like 40 miles out of the way with my youngest daughter in the car. I didn't care. The things that I did after my shooting, the poor coping, I just didn't give a shit. I didn't care. And that's my kid. I mean, come on, man. And another way I poorly coped was casual sex. I would meet women online and we'd mutually agree to have sex. And sometimes we'd meet and within 30 minutes we're having sex. And, you know, we weren't making love. It wasn't even sex. It was just chasing that dopamine
rush.
It's
a dopamine hit. Yeah. Yeah.
And I did that many times. And it's just, you know, I remember one time I'm laying in bed with a woman after we had sex. And sex to me is fun. It's playful. It's exciting. It feels good. You know, I wish I could have more of my life, right?
Every man does.
Right, right. And so I'm laying in bed with a woman after we had sex, and I'm thinking, what are you doing, man? You need to stop this. I started not liking myself. And it didn't fix anything. It just caused me more stress, more anxiety, more depression, because I always worried, what if I get her pregnant? What if I catch an STD? But even that didn't slow me down. Even that didn't make me want to stop casual sex.
Well, you're just bouncing from one means of escape to another, and that's what it is. And people who haven't struggled with addiction won't understand that, but that is everything that you've said is an extension of that initial, okay, I'm gonna have some drinks to take the edge off, and then that turns into more and more, and then like the extension of continually justifying worse and worse behavior. It is, yes, right. You're still kind of chasing that dragon in different ways, but that justification is an extension of the same line of thinking that got you there in the first place. And it does, at the same time, like, you know, when you stop long enough to sober up or stop long enough to have that post-nut clarity where you're like, okay, something I'm not doing right here. It's like then the weight and like the realization of how much you are fucking up then feeds back into that where you're like, okay, now I need to escape from that too. and you said
the magic word, because like I said, we weren't making love. We weren't having sex. We were fucking. That's all it was.
Yeah.
It was to feel good. We were both getting something out of it. And you're right. I mean, did it help momentarily? Sure. The alcohol helped momentarily. The sex, you know, I even tried marijuana for the first time in my life. I smoked it. I tried a gummy. And I always prided myself in never doing drugs ever. I remember before I even got into the Army, there's something called the MEPS station. I don't know how that is in the Marines, but you got to go in and get all these physicals and tests done. And I remember they're asking me, have you ever done marijuana? And I'm like, I've never done marijuana. And they're like, You can tell they didn't believe me.
Yeah.
And they're like, no, it's okay. You can still be a cop in the Army if you've done drugs. I'm like, I've never done drugs. And you could tell they didn't believe me. But after my shooting, I didn't care. I was looking for the next thing to make me feel better, to make me feel good, even if it was momentarily. And like you said, when you get a little bit of that clarity after you do this, the anxiety killed me. It was like a million butterflies in my stomach. I just wanted to lay on the couch, lay on in bed, wrapped up in a blanket, hide underneath the blanket, not interact with anybody. That anxiety after I did all this stuff would kill me, but it still wasn't enough to stop, because then I was like, okay, where's the alcohol? Who's the next person I can have sex with? I did this for years.
Yeah, it's a weird, and again, like, you know, I struggled with rampant alcoholism. So like, I totally get what you're saying. Other people will hear that and be like, what the fuck are you talking about? But it is just, you're running from things. And as you run from them with these escapisms, as opposed to, because you are just stuffing them down. That's all you're buying yourself a temporary buffer there to disengage from that discomfort.
Right.
But it does compound, and I think that is really a big part outside of the chemical component of addiction, right? Like, I think that is a huge part of the reason that people get stuck in addiction. You see people throw their entire lives away is because the farther you get into that, the harder it does get to break it because of that compounding factor. And at the same time,
yeah,
as you're doing all that, you are degrading your ability to cope with stress, because the threshold at which you are abusing, whether it's sex or substance or gambling or food, because, especially in America, a lot of people have food addictions and we just don't talk about it. It's with body positivity instead of...
I'm an emotional eater. So, I mean, I a couple of years ago, I realized that one of my triggers was eating pizza, because I love pizza. You know, I'm lactose intolerant, but I'll still eat a whole freaking pizza. I don't care. But that was one of my biggest go-to after my shooting was I'd order a pizza. And I never realized that up until probably a couple years ago, that when I started eating a pizza, I'd eat like 8 slices. And I'm like, why? I'm not that hungry. But then I realized, wow, that's what I did all the time. I ordered a pizza when I wanted that comfort food, Yeah, I'm an emotional eater, so I gotta kind of watch that. Otherwise, I'll eat all kinds of stuff.
I would imagine being a lactose intolerant in Wisconsin is like,
it's
a heresy.
Oh yeah, I mean, I love cheese and milk and cream, and we got everything. There's milk and cheese in, and it's kind of like, man, come on,
Yeah, that whole time, because eventually you did start getting help. Were there services available to you and you just weren't using them and something?
Yep, there were.
Okay.
Initially, I did. I went to our employee assistance program person, which she was great. She was a relative of one of the police officers on the department, and her husband was an active police officer in an adjacent community. So speaking with her was great, because I could just vent and talk about what was going on, and she just understood. She understood the jargon, because her husband was a cop for 20 plus years. So I didn't have to just share what I was going through and then explain it all to her. So that was good. And then after that, I kind of took some time off, but then I went to another therapist. And I remember the first time I went to this therapist, it was great. It felt great. I could vent and just unload all kinds of stuff, but for 45 minutes, but I remember leaving. And then I'm thinking, that was such a freaking waste of time. She has no idea what I'm talking about. She has no idea what I'm going through. So I would go for a couple months and then take a few months off, and then go for a couple weeks and then take the entire summer off and just go like when I wanted to. And I'd even get letters in the mail saying, you missed your appointments. We miss you. Please come back. And then there just came a point where I'm like, you know what? I don't need to go to therapy. I'm fine. If I just continue to do what I'm doing, I keep going, Everything's going to fall into place. Everything's going to work out. Everything always works out anyway, so I don't need to go. Look, I was wrong. I absolutely needed therapy, and I need it today. And I needed medicine. I take 20 milligrams of Lexapro every morning right now. I see a therapist every Monday at 5 p.m. I'm sitting on the couch, and I absolutely love her. But yeah. There were resources available to me. I just chose to use it every now and then. And then eventually I just said, forget it. I'm done. I don't need to. I'm doing well. I'm doing well at work. I'm getting awards. I'm getting medals. I'm getting citations. I'm good. Hey, I just got to keep going and things will work out.
It's almost like another way of writing off what was like, yeah, I'm struggling, but you know, I'm checking all the boxes. Almost.
Right. And you know, a year after my shooting, I was promoted to detective, the first detective in the history of the police department. So, you know, I, on top of my critical incident and struggling and suffering in silence, I continued to go to other critical incidents, other suicides and homicides and fatal car crashes and, you know, all that cumulative stress. And my mind was, as long as I just keep going, eventually everything will fall into place. Everything will work out and be fine. But I was wrong. I mean, I really needed help, but I wasn't going to reach out and ask for it.
Gosh. Yeah. I didn't even, I don't think I realized you went on to become a detective, but like with at that point, the repeated exposure to things. I mean, my dad hasn't talked about it a lot, but he was an OSI agent when he was in the Air Force. Are you familiar with OSI?
Oh yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's just even, I had someone on here and they were talking. I actually spoke with someone that he used to work with when he was in the OSI, and that you might know because he was also a police officer out in your area, Dave Jones. I know that's a super generic name, but right. He was talking about, I think it was him talking about having worked like child cases and stuff. And just like when my dad listened to that episode, he's like, man, that brings some stuff up like that. It's fucking rough. I don't want to talk about it, yeah. But like, dear God, that's takes a certain kind of person. And it's, I would imagine with you having not actually, it sounds like you hadn't really done the work to process any of this stuff. And now you're.
Yeah, I didn't.
Having that. And that's, I think that's a tough thing. Like you mentioned you were almost like picking and choosing when you were going to go to therapy. And that's, it obviously you realized that that's not how it works now.
Right.
Like
right.
It's, I think for people who haven't been to therapy, and you know, I still go to therapy once a week, and it's been 6.5 years since I shot myself, but. Once a week is, you know, I still struggle with stuff from as the result of head injuries and other stuff that I have going on in my life. Sometimes there's not a lot to do, but like that is, it's like any other form of maintenance on yourself. And it's, you're working out almost like emotionally there as opposed to going in the gym. Like if you just pick and choose, you're not going to get the results in any form of like self maintenance or self work that you're doing.
Right.
And it's
right. Yeah.
Also, you know, go ahead.
And it's okay. It's okay to see a therapist. It's okay to take medicine if you have to. It's helpful. It's so helpful. And, you know, when I see my therapist, we just don't talk about my shooting. We talk about everything else that's going on in life. And I look forward to it. And I go 4 times a month. And sometimes I'm like, yeah, that's too much. But when I don't go, I know I need it. And it's okay. And I wish more people, if they wanted it and they think they needed it, they would at least try. It can still be discreet. They can still do it in private. They don't have to get on a podcast and talk about all our stuff like you and I are doing.
Yeah.
There's so many resources out there that people can use. And there are people that truly want to help you, not just because they're getting paid for it, but because they really want to help you. I met so many strangers once I got cleared and went back on the road that said, hey, you know, we were thinking about you. We were praying for you. Can I give you a hug? And I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, wow, I don't even know these people. And these were genuine people that truly cared about me and how I was doing. So I always tell people, and I know it's not easy, but it's okay to talk about your mental health. You're not alone. You're not the only person that has gone through this. There's tons of people that go through stuff. And with, you know, I speak with a lot of people about mental health, and it really doesn't matter what their profession is either, or if they're unemployed. It's like we can all relate to each other one way or another. It doesn't matter where we live. It doesn't matter what our experience is, because we can still connect one way or another when we talk about mental health. So it's okay.
Yeah. And you're saying that having come from two career fields where like you don't talk about that stuff, the military is that way, which is actually really interesting. I just had a Green Beret on here recently, and like they have, you know, they have a psychologist on staff and like time set aside where they can go see that like in their normal work days. And like, it is, you know, it is suggested that you do and supported that you do. And it's interesting seeing that. And obviously those guys absolutely deserve the support, but like you wish that would carry over into other areas a little bit. But it's another thing, like you just said, with that speaking up is when people know that you're having a hard time or that you've been through something and you are at a point where you can talk about it, like they will come out of the woodwork to help you. Like people,
yep. Right.
People are good. People want to help and people will help, but you have to say something for people to know that you need that help.
Yeah. And it's not always easy. It's not always comfortable. It's awkward. I mean, even now, when I share my experience with other people, I feel kind of awkward at times because I don't want people to judge me. I'm worried about people judging me, especially, you know, I'm still a police officer. I'm a police captain in Wisconsin. And I'm like, yeah, somebody out here is going to judge me and say, you don't deserve to be a cop. You're a basket case. You don't, you know, but I still think it's okay. It's still okay to talk about it, to get help. You talk about the military. When I was in the Army, they always said, suck it up and drive on. And that's what we did. You know, it's like, just suck it up and drive on. Okay. That's what I'll do. And that's what I did.
Yeah. There's a place for that and a time for that, especially I think in the military, or, you know, if you needed to finish the rest of your shift that day, or even when you went back to work, like, hey, you need to stuff it down for these 8 hours or whatever it is. Like, but yeah, you need that room on the back end to where, okay, now we're opening the door for you, Adam. What do you need from us? What can we do for you right now? Because now, like, we're taking off the working hat, and now it's time for you to do the work behind the scenes a little bit. But is that how it is in 2022 when you started Stop the Threat, Stop the Stigma? And is it all in service of all of these things that you've learned and trying to bring that to others?
I started speaking about my critical incident in 2019 at Waukesha County Technical College in Wisconsin.
That's a hell of a name.
Then in 2020, I made a Facebook page like a lot of people do. And then in 2021, I made it into an LLC because I wanted to give it more credibility and just let people know that, hey, this is kind of the real deal. I'm not just doing this as a hobby. And what happened is, in December 28th, 2021, I attended active shooter training at a elementary school. And there was probably 20 or 30 police officers there, and they all knew me and I knew them. And we were watching a PowerPoint presentation about the different active shooters that happen in the United States and overseas. And I started getting really hot, uncomfortable, sweating profusely. I was seated like I'm sitting now, comfortably in a chair, and about a minute passed and I reached up to my forehead and it was drenched in sweat. I was having a panic attack. But the first thing I thought of was, I have to fight this and I have to hide it. And I think it's because of that stigma associated with mental health. And the thing is everybody there knew me. If I would have just, you know, at break, if I would have went to the instructor and said, I'm sorry, I can't do this. I gotta take a break. I gotta redo the training later. I'm having issues. It would have been okay. They knew me. They knew I was involved in the shooting. It would have been okay. But I truly believe because of that stigma, my first instinct was to fight it and to hide the panic attack. And I did. And I continued with the training. And I passed the training. And then I went on a couple days off. And I was a detective at the time. But New Year's Eve 2021. I worked uniform patrol, and I started my shift at 11 a.m., the same time I started my shift the day of my shooting. And I remember sitting in my squad and gearing up everything, and I thought to myself, you know what? Forget this. I'm done. I quit. I ain't doing this no more. And I don't think I wanted to quit being a cop. I think I wanted to quit coping the way I had been for years because it wasn't working for me. And I knew it wasn't working for me for years. You know, I'm talking about my mental health to people and telling people reach out and get help, but I was a hypocrite. I wasn't doing that. You know, when I was sharing my experience, I was still drinking. I was still having casual sex. I was still doing all this stuff. But that day I was like, enough's enough. I'm done. And I reached out to a sergeant and I asked him, I need you to come with me to the chief because I'm done. I'm quitting. And he's like, well, hold up. I'll be right there. And he's, you're not quitting, Adam. You're not quitting. I'll come with you to speak with the chief. And this was a different chief, not the same chief that was with me during my shooting because he had retired after 30 plus years. But we went in and talked to the chief and I told the chief, I'm done. I ain't doing this no more. I'm done. And he's like, no, you're not going to quit. Take a couple of days off, go, you know, and I did. And I took about 2 weeks off and then I reached out to the chief and said, I think I'm ready to come back to work. And he told me the only way that you can come back to work is you need to have a fitness for duty test, a psychological evaluation. And I was okay with that because that's what I was all about, right? I was all about talking about mental health and if you need help, get it. And so I scheduled that appointment, and the appointment was from 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. It was all day long, all kinds of different tests. And I remember that morning when I'm driving to take the test, I thought to myself, you know what? I'm going to lie. I'm going to beat this test. I don't need to do this shit. I'm fine. I'm just going to prove to them I'm fine and go back to work.
You're still almost kind of off putting like the bearing of responsibility there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I told myself, I'm just going to I'm going to beat the test, beat all these tests and go back to work. So I got there, I'm sitting in the waiting room and I thought to myself, you know what, Adam, the only way that you're going to get better is you have to be honest. You have to be honest. And that's what I chose to do. I chose to be honest. And after the evaluation, I was diagnosed with major depressive disorder, PTSD, acute stress with dissociative features. I was unfit for duty, and I went on a 90-day leave of absence at my police department. It was approved. And when I got this evaluation report, I was reading through it, and I started crying because it was me. It was my reality. It was answers to all the shit I had been doing through the years, all the questions I had. So I thought, okay, now what do I got to do to get better? What do I got to do? Here's all the answers. Let's go. And I did. I was attending therapy 2-3 times a week. I wasn't missing any appointments and I was getting better and I was feeling better. And I was also put on a safety plan because in that evaluation, there were some suicidal ideations. And I get that. And that's fine. I'm all for that. But you know, it's different. It's different when it's you. For years, I had always been there for other people and helped other people when they were in crisis, when they had to go on safety plans, but now it's me. So it's a whole different thing when it's you.
No, because then you have to face the discomfort.
This is the reality, Adam. Yeah. You need help. You have no other choice and you're being forced to do this. And I'm okay with that. That was a positive thing. So then that same month that I received, I was put on a safety plan. I lived outside of the community where I was a police officer. And one day a sergeant came out to my house in uniform in a squad car and gave me a written order to immediately cease and desist speaking about my personal testimonies when it relates to my shooting. And it said, basically, if you don't shut up, you're going to be disciplined or even terminated.
And I'm thinking from your department.
Yeah. The sergeant came out and gave that to me. And I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. I've been speaking about my mental health publicly. I've been on the news. I've been in the newspaper. I've been doing all of this since 2019. And now all of a sudden I'm on a leave of absence because of my mental health. Now I'm getting an order to basically shut up about it. And that scared the hell out of me. I shut down everything on Facebook. I shut down my website. I didn't know what to do. I did reach out to an attorney and said, hey, I'm getting this order. It's It's my right to do what I'm doing, and it's always been supported. What do I do? And that attorney reached out, and we had scheduled a meeting with the chief and the police department's attorney to kind of get to discuss this. And unfortunately, my leave of absence was expiring. And when it did expire, the chief called me in, and I admired him. I respected him. He had a long career in law enforcement, and I think he's still a good chief. And he asked me how I was doing, and we just kind of had small talk. And then the sergeant that gave me the order came into the chief's office, and we sat down, and the chief basically said, we're not extending your leave of absence. You can either resign or you're going to be terminated. And he literally had two forms in front of him. One was a resignation letter and one was a termination letter. And I thought it over and I said, you know, I'm not quitting. I've been here for 14 years. I'm not quitting. This is work related. So I didn't resign and I was terminated. And in the 14 years I had been at that police department, I had never been disciplined. I had never been suspended. I received awards. I was the first detective, the first officer in the history of the department with a shooting. I received medals, state citations. I was a good cop, and I still am. And I feel that they just washed their hands of me. And I remember being walked out of the police department that day. I went back to my detective office, and I boxed up a bunch of my stuff, and I'm walking out of the police department thinking, what the hell am I going to do now? This is my lifelong career to be a cop. And all I was doing was doing my job. And now I feel like I was just abandoned, just completely abandoned. And
yeah, and, yeah, when they finally recognize that you need help and they're like, bye.
Right. And what sucks is since then, that was May of 2022. Now, when I first went on my leave of absence in February of 2022, everybody stopped texting me, calling me, communicating with me in any way. I was ghosted. I'm still ghosted. Nobody, the people I worked with and went on life and death calls, the people who knew my kids, the people who knew my family and helped me move, it's like they don't give a shit about me anymore. It makes me question, were those relationships or those friendships even real? I love them, men and women. I loved going to work. They were like a second family. But then all of a sudden I go on a leave of absence because I'm struggling with my mental health and I get ghosted. And it's been more than 3 years and I still don't hear from anybody.
I wonder if that
really hurts.
Yeah. I wonder with that, you know, did the chief there kind of blacklist people like, hey, you know, if you don't stop communicating with Adam, you're fucking gone too. Because
yeah,
that's...
I would hope not, but I mean, I've heard of stuff like that happening. I mean, I hope that didn't happen there. But, you know, what's interesting is several months later after I had been terminated in May of 2022, and I think it was September of 2022, I spoke at a college in a community right next to where I was a police officer. And I spoke at their police academy, their recruit school, because my daughter was in it. And I shared my experience. And shortly after that, I received a letter from the police department's attorneys stating that you recently spoke at a college about your experience and you shared unfactual information, that you were terminated for your mental health. And it, to sum it up, it basically said, if you continue to do this, we're going to come after you. And I'm like, I never said that. I never tell anybody ever that I was terminated for my mental health. But you know what? It doesn't take a rocket scientist to listen to my story and to read the documents and the emails that I have to come to a conclusion like, yeah, they got rid of him because of his mental health. What was I on leave of absence for? My mental health. I was unfit for duty because of my shooting. Why? Because I was struggling with my mental health. I never tell anybody they terminated me because of that. But come on. And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. But and that kind of, you know, got me nervous and scared a little bit. But then I'm like, you know what? The hell with it. I'm going to keep going. I'm going to share my experience because I tell the truth. I have documents. I have emails. I have everything supporting this. I'm not making this shit up. I'm sharing my experience because it's going to help somebody, and it's bigger than me, and that's what I continue to do because I just want to help one more person because there's many police officers, many first responders, veterans, everybody out there struggles with mental health. So I just want to help. So I continue to do what I do.
Yeah, and I mean, that's, I've said this with a handful of these conversations that I've had on the podcast so far, where someone will hear this episode and be like, okay, I need to go get help. Another cop will hear this and
right.
go get help. Like that, well, and is, you know, there's power there was in that.
Yeah, one morning I was sitting having coffee, watching the news and, you know, checking my phone, and I got this message from a counselor. And it was after I spoke at a sheriff's department. I had no idea who she was. And she goes, hey, Adam, I just want to let you know an officer came to speak with me today because they heard you speak yesterday and thought it was time for them to get help. And I'm like, hell yeah. That's what it's all about. You know, because we do what we do. You know, you got your podcast and we talk and I public speak. And sometimes I'm like, you know, this is just too much. I need to shut it down. I need to take a break. I'm not even sure if this is worth it anymore. And then you get a message like that. That's what it's all about. And just think of all the other people that hear us or listen to your podcast and think, yeah, I need to get some help. Why? Because I was listening to Zach's podcast and yeah. So how many people that you reach that you don't know? I mean, it's so important.
Yeah. I mean, I've had people reach out, whether it was for the podcast or beforehand from sharing my own story, and just, it is, that can save someone else's life, man. Just
right.
the, and it's so, you know, if you remove the pain of getting to the point where you can talk about it, it is such a simple thing. Like, yes, getting to the point where you can talk about it and not be sweating and be miserable and not have that ruin your whole day is,
right.
That's a lot of work, but when you can get there, it's such a simple act that you can do that will save somebody and maybe pave the way for someone else. And I still, this whole time, since you know, at first when you said, and I still think he's a good chief, I was like, okay, there's going to be a silver lining here. And then it got worse. And it's like, I think the fact that you could still say that, whether you truly believe it or not, is some... that takes a lot of maturity there. And so I appreciate that. But that is just, you know, that can't be the only department around the country where, when that's kind of crazy to think that was happening in 2022, because like there's, you know, mental health is becoming less and less of a stigma slowly, but
right.
there's someone else has had a very similar situation to you, even in that sense, even if it wasn't, you know, on the shooting side of things or, but just having some shady circumstances lead to a, getting the point where you're getting voluntold to leave and don't let the door hit you on the way out.
Right. Can I share with you, Zach, something that happened to me, one of the ways that I poorly coped. It involves putting my gun to my head. And I don't know if it could, I don't know, maybe you can help me understand why. I mean, I, about a dozen times I put my duty weapon to my head. And what I would do is I still have the weapon. It's a weapon I carry now at the police department I work for now, but I easily put my gun to my head a dozen times all the time when I was intoxicated. But what I would do is I have a 40 caliber Glock Model 22, and I'd remove the magazine and I'd clear the chamber, you know, take the bullet out. And then I'd put my gun to my temple and I'd pull the trigger just because I wanted to hear that metallic click. Now, I don't know why I did that. I have no idea. I still don't. A lot of people say maybe you were preparing, but I don't know. And it wasn't until recently where I'm like, you know what? There's no other way to explain it. I had to have been preparing or thinking about suicide. I don't understand. Do you have any idea why I may have done something like that? I still don't get it.
Yeah. And but I want to preface this with something here is obviously I'm not a mental health professional, but
right.
I've been there because I went through with it and pulled the trigger.
Sure.
Also, I know some people might hear this and think that we are, Yeah. Because I've had this brought up to me before, like, oh, you shouldn't talk about it and share the details of what you did because that inspires other people to go do it. And research shows that that's not the case. So that is why I'm going to talk about this. I think some of that is, yes, you were intoxicated, but I think you are, that's, it's normal for people to occasionally, every once in a blue moon have the idea when things are shit where you're like, oh, maybe fuck, it'd be easier if I wasn't here, but then move on past it. And it sounds like, so instead of trying to dissect yours, I'll say what happened with me. I had struggled for over a year. It was around there, and hadn't been talking about it, was drinking. And then so I shot myself on March 31st, 2019. That was finally like, but I had known for a while beforehand, like, hey, I'm getting to the end of my line here. On March 27th, 2019, I was stone cold sober and did what you did. And this, I cleared my gun out. I'd never mishandled a firearm in my life. I'd been out of the Marines for about 9 months. This was my concealed carry firearm. I emptied it out and just held it to my head, and I held it in between my eyes because that's where we were trained to shoot for headshots, is that the T box, right? But for me, that was a, okay, now I know, like, I needed an escape, and I found it. As fucking crazy as that is, I felt relief in that moment because I was like, ah, there is an escape, which is so, that's, I talk about you, when you've reached that point, you are not in a sane state of mind anymore. And that's, I would argue, for you, whether that was, obviously some of that was emotional pain for you to be there and holding it. Some of that's also the alcohol. Like, I was sober that night, but on the 31st, I was not when I shot myself. And so that's a huge component when you look into suicides, especially men tend to be more violent, but a lot of times there's substance involved. And so you have to wonder, and I wonder about this with mine. It's like, okay, had I not drank that night, would I have gone through with that? And that's like with you, okay, if it only ever happened when you were drinking, like some of that, the at least like the final straw there for you to get to that point of actually holding the gun to your head and clearing it out and taking that action to even see what it feels like. Some of that was the booze talking. And it's, yeah.
I mean, it's, and I always wonder, like, how many times did I do it when I was so intoxicated I don't remember? I mean, and with a Glock, if you take the magazine out, it'll still go bang if you got one in the pipe. Some guns you can take the magazine out and it doesn't discharge anything, but I'm like, wow, how many times did I do it when I was so blackout drunk I don't remember? I very well could have killed myself. And yeah, I just don't. It's something that I always just, I'm just curious about. I just don't get it.
It's a weird, like, morbid curiosity where you start playing the what if game with that, right? Yeah. And it's, and it is hard because with people who booze to the professional level that we have, like, they don't understand the, there's like a different side of you that comes out when you're that drunk, right? Like, it is like this weird, it's your lizard brain kind of operating and doing its own thing. So I don't know. I mean, I'm glad you didn't go through with it,
Yeah,
right?
me
Like,
too.
this, yeah. It's, I don't know, man. And a lot of people, like, more, I'm sure you probably hear it a lot too, just with speaking about your story. Like, and I realize in doing that, I do get people approaching me about it a lot, and or and saying, okay, either they've dealt with it directly or they've known somebody, a very close family member, or they lost someone to suicide or something. And it seems like so, it's so much more common than you would think. And I realize obviously that is a certain subset of the population that I'm hearing from, but it is, it's, there's so many people out there that are at that level of despair where that's hopefully where these conversations will step in and save a life. Because if you're at that point right now and then you hear us talking about this and like, okay, there's another side of this. It is, all right. What did they say they did to get out of that? Okay, they went, they first, they spoke up. Okay, that was, it was therapy. Cool. How can I find a therapist? Or, ooh, it just needs to be someone who you trust to say something. You just need to, and it's, I, it can save lives, man. So It's what's next here on the docket with you? And I mean, you're pushing forward with Stop the Threat, Stop the Stigma. Are you putting programming together? Is there a book coming? Is it all you speaking and teaching a curriculum?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things happening. We're number one, we're kind of revamping the website right now. When you talk about a book, I am working on a book right now with a doctor. Kind of, I will share my experience and they will explain it all. So once that's said and done, you'll be able to read it and then understand why I did certain things, have some meaning behind it, not just reading a story. I did write a chapter in a book. The book was called Take Back Your Power. I wrote a chapter in there. It was the first time I ever wrote a chapter about my experience. And the title was If I'd Only Broken My Leg, because I truly believe that if I had broke my arm or leg, I would have went to the doctor, got a cast, and everything would have been fine, and I'd go back to work and I would have been treated differently. I truly believe that I was treated the way I was because it's mental health. And if I would have been physically injured, it would have been a different story. But with Stop the Threat, Stop the Stigma, I established that to promote law enforcement, wellness and even just all first responders in hopes that they will hear my story and inspire them to speak about their mental health, to reach out to get help. But not only police, fire, EMS, and other first responders, but anybody. It doesn't matter what job you're in. It doesn't matter if you're unemployed. There's resources out there, and my website has that. What I would like to do is I would eventually down the road, not only me speak, but also have firefighters and paramedics and military and EMS and everybody kind of like come together and share our experiences because that's powerful. I mean, when we work together, there's nothing we can't accomplish. I mean, it's wonderful. I mean, there's somebody named Chris Prohut, and I watch him every time he speaks. And he's a former police captain, and he's amazing. And I remember one of the many things I learned from him was when he was speaking, he goes, if you want to share your experience, don't think that nobody's going to listen to you. Don't compare your story to somebody else because we all have our story, and different people are going to learn different things from us. And I needed to hear that because I remember I'm thinking, nobody's going to want to hear my story and nobody's going to want to listen to me. I wasn't in a big shootout. I wasn't shot. I wasn't anything like that. There's no real excitement to my story. But after hearing Chris Prohut say that, I'm like, wow, that was motivation right there. I needed to hear that. And that just motivated me to continue to speak and then come up with, other plans for Stop the Threat, Stop the Stigma. And I just hope that Stop the Threat, Stop the Stigma continues to grow, either online or in person, and that we can get more and more people working together to share their experience and kind of knock down that stigma because there is a stigma with mental health. I truly believe it's always going to be there. It's getting better because of, what you and I are doing, talking about it. And so many more other people are talking about it, and that's important. So I just think that if I just continue doing what I'm doing and getting more people on board, it'll help, stop that stigma and things will get better.
Yeah, and this brings me back to a question I wanted to ask you earlier, and I missed the chance that
Sure.
I'll ask you here. But like with you saying, like there always being a stigma, really the only negative encounters I've had with my story outside of like early on before I was comfortable telling people that I shot myself, I would get negative responses because the way that I would tell it was horrible. Like I would avoid telling it, and then when people get pushing my buttons, I'd be like, I shot myself in the face, and then you don't usually get a good response from that. But usually outside of that, and very, very few and far between is like people who seem to lack like the intelligence to put themselves in someone else's shoes, and right, like to that can't picture themselves reaching that point or stop and like maybe consider what that might be like and realize like, yes, I know what I did was a mistake. I know, but that place that you're in is also, it is not a rational place, like I talked about earlier. But with you, because you mentioned specifically, and bringing up Chris Prohut kind of ties back into that, you mentioned this like very, very early on in our conversation of, you were worried about speaking up because people would judge you. And I know now, obviously, over the past couple of years, there's been a lot of turmoil in the way that people view police officers in general. And I don't think that's how the masses view police officers. I think that's the loud minority, and they seem to have gotten a bit of a megaphone that kind of pumped up their signal there for a little bit. But have you actually had experiences where people are outwardly and like confrontational with you about it? And then if so, how common is that?
I haven't had face-to-face experiences. I've received emails. I've received other messages.
Keyboard warriors. Yeah.
Sure. I mean, shortly after my shooting, I even received hate mail, and it was never signed by a name. It didn't even have return address on the envelope. Almost for many years after my shooting, around the time of the anniversary of my shooting, I would start getting messages, and a lot of the messages came through Facebook. And, I guess they were trying to remind me that I killed somebody, not like I'll ever forget. But when I started digging into that, it was always somebody trolling me. It was always somebody who made up a fake Facebook account, sent me messages, and then that was it. Because I would see the account and it would say, like, created yesterday or something like that.
So yeah, that was two friends. Yeah.
Right. There was one guy when I still worked at that police department when I was a detective. I was investigating him for illegal dumping. It was something very minor. I issued him, I think, maybe one or two ordinance citation tickets. He was a construction worker. He dumped a bunch of his stuff in somebody's garbage, and it was on video, and I wrote him some tickets. Well, he didn't like that, so he posted on the police department's Facebook page that, Detective Myers, you lying, murderous pussy, you kill women, all this other stuff, and I'm like, really, this has nothing to do with anything. And it's, people who knew that I shot and killed somebody and didn't like the police, they would bring it up whenever they had an opportunity, but never face to face. They were like, what, keyboard bandits or whatever
keyboard
you want to call
warriors,
kind of just hide behind there. And I actually welcomed that. If you don't agree with what I did and what I'm doing now, speaking about mental health, let's talk about it. Let's have that conversation. Let's have that debate. Because even if you don't agree, we're still talking about it, and that's good. Even with my Stop the Threat, Stop the Stigma Facebook page, there's times that I get messages. There's times that I get posting. You have no right being a cop. You're mentally unstable. I can't believe that they still let you carry a gun. It's good that they fired you years ago, stuff like that. And it's like, initially it upset me. I'm not going to lie, it did. I don't like that kind of stuff. But then I realized, just like you said, the masses, the majority of the people support police. They want cops. They support them and they appreciate us. And that's what I fall back on. And when I first started my career in law enforcement, I worked for the Racine Police Department, my hometown. And my chief at the time was David Spenner. And I remember we were working on different projects together. And one of the things that he told me was, ignore the naysayers. Just ignore the naysayers. If you know you're doing the right thing and you're helping people, ignore the naysayers. And I know that's not always an easy thing to do, but that has stuck with me since 2001. And, I just keep doing what I'm doing because I know that I'm helping and doing the right thing, and people need people like, you and I to put ourselves out there and share because we're helping people.
Yeah, and I'm not. I it's obvious that you realize this now, so I'm not like saying this to lecture you. I'm saying this so other people can hear it and like stop and think about it. And also, the people that are posting that stuff are reaching out to you, especially with no name behind it. Like their identity is hidden. These people are one, either losers or two, stunted in some way, right? Like the people saying like, oh, you're not fit to be a cop. They should have fired you years ago. Like that is someone, again, who's doesn't have the intelligence to like stop and be more objective about a situation. But a lot of the people who are just like shit posting stuff, and I'm saying this because I reached that point before I shot myself. I was so miserable that I was lashing out to strangers online. Like it was, those are the people on the other side of that are miserable. And that is all that that's coming from is they're lashing out instead of dealing whatever shit they have on. That was me hammered, probably sitting around in my underwear, being fucking depressed. And just instead, I'm going to talk shit to some fucking stranger on the internet who happened to cross through my algorithm. Like that's what 99% of those people are. Right. And
Right.
it's, you know, that's, I think, you know, we see it with teen girls get cyber bullied a lot. And it's obviously, I can't imagine there's a teen girl that's going to listen to this podcast, but like, this is anyone who's listening who ends up in some sort of public eye like that. When you hear people reaching out, those are people who are unwell. And so
Right.
that's, again.
I have a piece of hate mail here. If you'd like me to read it, I can read.
Yeah,
Okay.
do it.
All right, so I received this at the police department shortly after my shooting. There's no signature at the bottom. There was no return address on the envelope, and it was mailed to the murderous cop, and then it had, you know, our police department's address. So this is what it says. It goes, "Hey, to the murderer cop, what the hell is your big, strong arm trained macho man bastard serving the community policeman doing shooting and murdering a 25-year-old young lady in a Walmart store? Throw some socks at her, or a chair, or a few pillows, or a bicycle, or some spray, or a taser. You son of a bitch, murderous cop. I hope a drunk driver shoots you."
Yeah, that's babble. Like
Right.
that's babbling run-on sentences that don't even
Right.
make sense. And it's just like that
Yeah.
person is unwell or 14 years old.
Yeah.
It's one of the
Well, and
two.
it was even written with like three different kinds of pens or pencils or
Oh,
whatever. It
Jesus
looks like
Christ.
maybe a Sharpie marker, maybe a pen. Yeah, it's ridiculous. But you know, when you're going through something like I went through and you get something like this, my chief at the time told me, "Hey, you're getting hate mail. I'm not going to let you read it right now, because I know how you are. You're an emotional guy. You're going to dwell on it." And I'm grateful for that. And I don't think I read this until probably 4 years after my shooting. And because that was the time to read it. And but when I read something like that, or when you read comments on, you know, Facebook, or it just in the beginning, it got to me. It really got to me. But over time, when you heal and you understand what all this means, it gets easier to read, and it get you, you I get easier with, you know, having something like
Yeah.
that.
And it's when you're in a vulnerable place, obviously that stuff piles up. But like you said, with the healing is more, once you can own it, like it's kind of hard for someone else to take control of that and use it over you. Right.
Right,
Like it's,
right.
and it is, it's just coming to terms with it. And that only happens through doing the work. And it's just, I think you should be proud of the fact that you got yourself out of that hole, man. I mean, that is, you, when you were talking about your lows there, I was like, that sounds eerily familiar to me. And it
Yeah.
just, so I admire you for it, man. And just,
Thank you.
I'm sure it's, you know, when I share stuff like that about my own story, that's not like a proud thing for me to share. I don't like sharing it. Even like in my book that's is about to go into editing here, is I talk about some shit in there that I really like don't want to put in there, but I think
I'm doing that now.
you're doing it. That's what I'm saying. You're doing it.
Yeah.
But I think that's like, that's another powerful thing that needs to be included in these stories of overcoming that like people usually don't, because it's not, it doesn't paint you in the best light, right? But it is, it does put you in a human light, right? And it makes it
Oh, yeah.
more relatable. So
I
I
didn't
just,
realize writing a book was going to be so difficult and emotional. And I'm like, man, I thought it would be a lot easier, but it's. I'm really digging deep and putting stuff in there that I don't even, you know, share publicly. And it's, but it's important. It's
yes.
the truth, and I want people to know it. So, I mean, but it's not easy to do.
Yeah, and I just that reminded me. I wanted to ask you, kind of tying back to what you asked me. Have you asked this doctor about basically those same questions that you asked me about when you did hold your gun to your head?
I have, and it's kind of like maybe pre-planning,
Yeah.
but also because, you know, I had alcohol on board, that definitely influenced that, because I
Yes.
never did it when I was sober. I never just took it out kind of like ha ha ha, and no, I would never. And it was always when I was intoxicated and, you know, kind of like, quote unquote, having that pity party with myself and
yes.
my life sucks and nobody loves me and it would be easier just to do this. And I do think it was highly influenced by alcohol. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's an interesting one. And that's how, like, I wasn't sure necessarily how to answer because, like, the night I decided I was sober and then, you know, I drank the day that I shot myself because I wanted some liquid courage, but it's, I'm glad you're still here, man. And I mean, is there any, what's that?
I'm glad you're here too, Zach.
Yeah. Where can people find you? Do you have any sort of timeline on the book? It sounds like you guys are still kind of in the grind of like cranking it out, right?
Yeah, we're still cranking it out. I mean, like I said, I wrote a chapter in the book called Take Back Your Power. I mean, that's on Amazon. And you know, if somebody wants to pick that up, it's actually 21 different stories about resilience and struggles and stuff like that. It's a good read. And that's found on Amazon. My goal with my book is to have, hopefully, to have a rough draft by February of next year, because that's when I turn 51. I'm not sure if that's going to happen, but that's kind of a goal. And, you know, if people want to reach me, they can visit stopthethreatstopthestigma.org. They can email me at adam@stopthethreatstopthestigma.org. And my phone number, my actual phone number, is on the website too. And if you want to talk, if you want to text, if you want to reach out and ask questions, I'll do the best I can to respond to you and provide you with resources. And if I don't know, I'll do the best I can to find those for you. Cause you know, I'm also a certified peer specialist in the state of Wisconsin and take a lot of pride in that because it's, you know, it's because of my lived experience that I can help other people. And it's not just, I'm not just book smart. You know, I went through all that shit and it's relatable to so many people. So, I mean, that's why I think being a peer specialist is so important to me because all I got to do is just be myself and share my experience and be there for other people and meet them where they're at. And I think people, when they struggle and they reach out for help, they know that you're legit. They know that you've been through some stuff and you're not just book smart, you know, they can tell. And I think that's really important for helping them heal or even really important for them to reach out for help.
Yeah, because I think you had even mentioned with your therapist, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you had said something to the effect of like, she doesn't know what I'm going through kind of stuff.
Yeah, that was one of the very first therapists that I went through. Yeah. And yeah, like I said, it was nice to vent and talk about it, but I remember leaving thinking that's a complete fucking waste of time. Yeah. She has no idea. And it's not her fault. And you know, when I first started going to therapy, I didn't know there were special therapists that specialized with first responders or with critical incidents. I had no idea. I thought, hey, if I just go to a therapist, that's all I need to do. But, you know, there's specialists out there and you need to find the right kind of therapist in order to get the right kind of help.
Yeah, I actually, and all this episode will be out before yours comes out, but it's not currently out as of us recording right now. But I just spoke with, his name is Dr. Charles Drebbing, and he's worked for 34 years in the VA and was the chief of mental health at two different VA hospitals. But he has done a ton of research and like work in promoting and developing these peer support systems, like not just in the VA, but recognizing the value of them as a larger whole. And you might find that one pretty interesting. So I'll have to send that to you when it comes out. Cause it was just, and that shit maybe connect you to if you'd be interested in that, but
yeah, absolutely. That sounds okay. Great.
I will have links to whatever you have sent me in the show notes.
Okay.
Again, people can email the murderous, strong-armed bastard cop at stopthestigma.org, right? That's what you said.
Right, yeah. That's my alias.
Yeah, yeah. So thank you so much for coming on, man, and just being open about it all. Again, I realize it sounds like it's easy for you now, but I know that had to have taken an incredible amount of work to get there. So thanks.
Thanks, Zach. I appreciate it. This is therapeutic. It's still a little triggering, but it's helpful and it's worth it because all I want to do is help somebody else. So, and that's worth it.
And thanks everyone at home for listening to another episode of Going In Blind. Remember, if you haven't already, please rate and review the show wherever you listened. Go join my mailing list on my website at zachtidwell.com so you can get news when my book is coming out. And then share this episode around so that someone who needs to hear it will.